Congratulations! You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast, with me, Kate Rhodes, and usually Maysoon Wazwaz, but I accidentally took the recording equipment to a secret vortex, and I'm broadcasting this from another region. So, anyhow, we're brought to you by the Compensation Foundation. They got a thing up. You're not going to believe it. It's the Bay Area Artist Report, which is an ongoing anonymous platform for visual artists to report and investigate compensation practices in their field. You can get on there, fill out a survey about your compensation experiences in various art activities with institutions in the Bay Area at compensationfoundation.org. You can also see some fantastic data visualizations of the reports they've already received, hundreds of them. So check that out. We'll talk more about compensation later in the episode. But right now, let's get to our interview. Speaking to artist, educator, Amy Ho. Welcome.
Hi, Kate.
Okay, let's take it all the way back to your entire birth and childhood.
I was born on the same day as Davy Crockett.
Wow.
Not the same day, the same day of the year, sorry.
Right. What day is that?
August 17th. Everybody send me birthday presents.
You're a Leo then.
I am a Leo, although I don't feel like a Leo.
Do you believe in astrology?
I'm indifferent.
And where were you born?
In Chicago. Does that make a difference?
So was my grandma.
Oh.
Okay, go on.
Doesn't it matter, like, astrologically where on the planet you were born?
It does to know your ascending sign.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know your
rising
sign?
No, I don't.
Okay.
We'll
look that up later. But you kind of grew up in, like, a few different places.
Oh, I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. I grew up moving around a lot, and I think that's shaped how I interact with the world. But it's a bit silly because I basically grew up in this sort of utopian world. I moved around a lot and went to a lot of international schools, and you go to school with, like, people from all over the world. And I remember, even though a lot of the schools were originally started by missionaries because they're abroad and they're English-speaking schools, they try to really emphasize, like, various different religions around the world. And so I remember, like, learning about Islam and Judaism as well as Christianity, like, when I was growing up, which is kind of cool.
So, like, where all?
Oh, where did
where
I
are
live?
You? Yeah.
I lived in Rome, in Antwerp, in Hong
Kong.
Holy,
I didn't know Antwerp.
Yeah.
That's in Belgium.
Yeah. And Hong Kong and Tokyo.
And wild.
Houston and Chicago. And that's it.
Houston's in the mix.
Yeah.
That's an odd one out, I'd say. Fourth biggest city in America, though.
Oh, is it? Oh.
Nothing to sniff at. Oh. And then you also had kind of an interesting pre-art life where you weren't an artist right out of the gate.
Yeah, no, yeah, I was working like when I graduated from undergrad, I worked in an office job for like 3 years, but it basically was saving money to go to grad school. So
for art.
Yeah, yeah.
You knew at that point, you were like, I'm getting out of this rat race.
But
you really had it like that planned out?
Yeah, but I mean, I wanted to save money for grad school, so it kind of, like, worked out. I don't know.
What was your undergrad degree in?
Oh, multiple things. I had a degree in art, of course, and then, well, not of course, but I had a degree in art, and then also in business.
Uh-huh.
And then I minored in political economy of industrial societies.
What?
It's like studying how politics and economics sort of intertwine.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but it was cool. Yeah.
Cool. Do you have any good economics jokes?
No, I don't know anything about economics, I feel like.
Do you want to hear my economics
okay,
joke?
Yeah.
Okay, what's the difference between macroeconomics and microeconomics?
One letter. No, two letters.
That's even a better answer. But the way I heard it was microeconomics is wrong about specific things and macroeconomics is wrong about things in general. It's just very interesting to me that you had such a clear vision of what your plan was, where you were like, I'm going to work in an office, save money, and go to grad school. And you really had that as your, like trajectory.
Well, no, but I also like got the job because my parents paid for my undergrad and I kind of felt like that's what they wanted me to do. And so that's what I did.
Right.
To please them, basically.
For like filial obligation.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you went to grad school over there at Mills.
Oh, yeah, I did. It feels like a long time ago.
And now you're an artist.
Yeah.
And that brings us up to current time.
Basically.
This is the deepest we've ever gone with an interview.
Oh.
Where we like really fully got the life story picture.
I'm embarrassed.
So a lot of your work has to do with like space.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of my work basically deals with how we understand space, both physically and psychologically. So how we sort of navigate space through our bodies, but then also how we react to spaces through our consciousness. I guess I've been, like, people often ask, like, why that? Like, why is that interesting? And I don't think I know exactly the answer, but I think part of it has to do with the fact that I don't know the answer, and then I guess it's sort of maybe because it's a universal thing, but that I don't know the answer to why we exist and live as these sort of dual beings. I don't think I'll ever know the answer, and that's why it's interesting.
Like dual beings, like in terms of mind and body being separate?
I mean, a lot of people will argue that they're not actually separate things, and I would agree also that there's something confusing about it, and that's why I'm interested in it. And I can't even quite pinpoint the question exactly, but it has to do with like this sort of like paradox of being in space, I guess. I feel like it's a paradox. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because you like, so part of your work is making like paper miniature models of spaces, rooms and things, and then like shooting them and then projecting them big, like a big ass space onto a flat surface. So you're making like a three-dimensional world, two-dimensional, but with an illusion that it is a three-dimensional space that you're in, but really it was like a tiny paper thing. So there's a lot of paradoxes there.
Yeah, and I like that idea that it never exists, the models that I make and then photograph never exist as real spaces. They're always objects, at least in relation to our bodies. And so like the idea that we look at the final works and believe it to be a space has something to do more with us than it does with what the actual like work is. Mm-hmm. Like it's just a photograph of an object, but somehow we believe it to be a space. And so really the work is kind of completed in our understanding of it, if that makes sense.
Have you ever had people kind of try to walk into one smash into a wall?
Well, not like they hurt themselves, but I've definitely had people go up to it and like kind of touch it, like they're uncertain of what is happening.
So you were in this, you made an installation for this project in Oakland a couple years ago where it was like an old doctor's office, and some of the artists like each took one of the like office room places, and yours was like, that was pretty trippy.
It was really dark in the space.
So dark. You'd really have to be in there a while to kind of adjust how the light was.
Yeah.
Can you describe it a little bit?
Oh, yeah. And so the light in that space was a recording. Basically, it was a room with a skylight, and I recorded the light level just with a camera throughout the course of the day, so you could see sort of the change from daylight to sunset to nighttime, and then to sunrise again, and then played that video inside of the sky. Like I blocked off the skylight and played the video.
Yeah, it was like a light tight room.
Yeah,
almost.
Yeah. But it was at such a low level that when you came in, it felt completely dark when you walked in. But then as you sat, you'd feel like the light was still there, but it took a while to notice that there was light in the room. And I think some people went in and were like, oh, there's nothing in here. And then they left. But that's okay. Yeah.
How is that for you?
Oh, I don't mind. I mean, I don't feel like somebody who has to dictate an experience to other people. So if they choose to spend time, that's great. And if they don't, then And I think it also has something to do with our expectations for art, but I don't presume that I can change that necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Now you're working on a project that's kind of taking like a lot of the same ideas that you were working on with projects like that, with like making like illusory spaces that involve the work you're doing at San Quentin. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I've been doing a series in collaboration with some of the guys that I met at San Quentin where they're creating artwork.
And you've been there for like how long
now? Oh, I've been teaching there for 5 years now. Yeah. So in this project, the guys are making either paintings or drawings or whatever medium they choose, depicting places that were significant to them before they went to prison. So essentially drawing on their memories to create these images. And then I'm hoping or trying to recreate these places as installations that viewers can then enter. But my version is very abstract and not
trying to like make an exact duplicate.
Yeah,
of the place.
Yeah. More like an abstracted version of it.
Is he outside the door? Yes. Let him in.
But yeah, essentially I'm creating these installations that hopefully will allow the viewer when they enter the space to create their own memory of the space and sort of, I mean, this sounds really cheesy, but then when they like leave, they then have a memory of that space. And I feel like that's some sort of weird connection that I've now created between the viewer and the inmate, even though they've never met physically. Mm-hmm. And I really like that idea of like one person's memory turning into another person's memory.
Yeah. So you did one of these at Royal Nunsuch Gallery with
Dennis Crooks. Yeah,
that was really interesting.
Yeah,
because Dennis's painting was like pretty damn big.
Yeah. And Dennis actually made that painting after he left San Quentin. We met at San Quentin and we started working on the project then, but he really didn't make his painting till he got out. And he knew he really wanted to make a giant painting, and so that's why he waited.
Because it wouldn't have been possible to do that at San Quentin.
It's like 4 feet by 5 feet, so yeah, it's quite big. And it's an amazing painting, but a really funny thing is somebody that came to see the show said to me that that the painting looked like a memory, but that the installation looked like a dream.
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, that totally makes sense because Dennis's is made from his memory, of course, and then mine is actually made more from my own imagination, essentially.
Right. Based on like his description.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you don't see necessarily... Do you see the work that
No, I don't. Yeah, that's part of the sort of the way the project has unfolded is that I don't, like, I'm creating or designing the installations at the same time that they're creating their artwork, so I don't see the finished product until I'm almost done.
You just are going
from
their description.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got one up right now over down there at San Diego State, right?
Yeah.
And who were you working with on that one?
For that one, I was working with Chanthan Bun. I call him Bun. But actually in that show, we're showing two installations. I've only done three of these now, but we're showing two of them. And the third one, we actually showed Dennis's painting, the hallway one, and models that I made of it, but not the actual installation.
Yeah.
But yeah, that show is up at San Diego State University's Downtown Art Gallery, and it's up from now until January 28th.
Go check it out.
Yeah.
Go on down. How was the weather down there? Because you just came back.
It's so nice.
Okay, great. Yeah, get down there. But was that where you were working with Bun and he was kind of like, when you first started, he was kind of like, I don't have a place that
exactly.
Because the kind of idea was a place before, you know, they came to San Quentin and a place that was like a happy memory.
And it's sort of interesting because when I originally came up with the idea and I was like talking to the guys in my class about it, I had an outline that it had to be a good memory and we had discussed like, should we do bad memories? And I was kind of like, oh, wait, that's not really the direction that maybe this should be going in.
And probably not a thing that somebody necessarily wants to focus on.
Yeah,
They're, you know.
Yeah, but it was like for some of the guys, the first place that came to mind, you know. So it was, I guess that was surprising to me. But I guess I'm always like constantly learning things from inside. So it's not surprised that I'm that I was surprised.
Right.
But the space with Bun, yeah, he actually like joined the project later, but and he essentially overheard us talking about it, and so one of the other guys was describing to him like what the whole premise of it was, and then so I asked Bun, I was like, do you have a space that was special to you that you would want to see recreated? And he essentially said no.
Right.
And then told me that his childhood was pretty rough and that there was no like place that was sort of safe from all the trauma that he had experienced. And so I didn't want to like push it too much. So I just sort of like left it at that. But then later on he came back and he was like all excited. And he basically described to me this fort that him and his cousins and his uncle and aunt, and his uncle and aunt were like the same, not that much older than him, that essentially they built this fort in the abandoned lot next to their apartment building, and hung out there for like a summer and played games and read comic books, and they had their baseball collection there, and there was even a fish pond at one point, although I don't think the fish pond was very long lived because I think the fish died very quickly.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then and apparently there was a ghost that lived there, so
oh yeah. So this one is kind of like the most complicated one you've done so far.
Yeah, it was really complicated. It also feels very different for me as an artwork, like as an installation. It's very different from I think what people think of when they think of my work, but I'm very excited to like recreate Bun's description, though, because we've been talking about it a lot, and every time I see Bun I feel like he has something new to tell me about that space. So I'm just very excited that I had the chance to like remake it. Yeah, we spent a lot of time talking about materials and things like that, and even though it's not, it doesn't have the sort of projection that I normally use in my work, it's still kind of, it's much more like fun than some of the other work.
Oh, right on.
Well, there's like I tried to recreate the fish pond, but it's all through projection, so it's not an actual fish pond, but I don't think that's something I've done ever before, so it's kind of whimsical, I guess.
Mm-hmm. How'd it go? This is kind of delving into our studio corner segment where we really get into the nitty gritty, but you use some software. What is that called again?
Oh, I use this projection mapping software called VPT, and I think it stands for Video Projection Tool.
To kind of map projection onto an object.
Yeah. And I was having some trouble with it before, but somehow I sorted it out.
Oh, it all worked out. Yeah. So how long is the video?
It's like 7 minutes or so.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Awesome.
So yeah,
man, you were having a rough time up there.
I think it was just because I was feeling like super rushed and I couldn't think clearly anymore.
Right. Always at the right before installation, the mind fog.
Yeah. And then
God.
I've been there. Always like, man, I wish I'd done this earlier, or I wish I'd had time to do this earlier. But never.
That's the life we lead. But I think what another thing that was kind of interesting to me about this project is, like, especially when you're collaborating with someone who's kind of like has to kind of struggle to think of a place, it's interesting that they're kind of, I think you've talked about it before, it's like they're kind of creating the place in their head.
One of the other guys that I worked with, Bobby Evans, he described to me sort of the process of working on this, and he said that as he was working on it, he felt like he was going back in time into that space.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of exciting.
It's just like an interesting kind of meditative exercise, I think, that I'm sure is like especially like maybe generative or comforting maybe to someone who's like in a place where they don't want to be.
Yeah. And it's also weirdly like a tie to like all the places that people have chosen relate to family somehow and home. And I think that's really important. Like, it actually, thinking about that place is a weird abstract way of being connected to your family, even though you're physically apart from them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's significant. Like, even in doing the project, their families can sort of become involved as well, which I think is sort of exciting. Like, with Bobby Evans's piece, his brother-in-law came to the show and he remembers the house. Bobby's mom still lives in that house, and when his brother-in-law saw Bobby's painting of it, he was like, oh my god, this is what the house used to look like, but it no longer looks like that. And so there's this sort of, even in real time, this connection to family. And Dennis was a little bit different because he was already out when he made the painting, but it was like 4 months after he finished the, 4 or 5 months after he finished the painting and after we had the show, he actually went back home to that house, and he hadn't seen his mother for a really long time, and he sent me a photo of the house, and it looks exactly like the painting.
Whoa, yeah. Wild.
Yeah. And then with Bun, hopefully his wife is going to be able to go and see the show. Mm-hmm. And then he was also telling me he really wants, well, I always give them photos of the work after, and that he wants to share the photos with his like uncle and cousins that actually had built the fort with him. Yeah. So that also, again, like, I feel like that tie to family is super important.
Do you have any tips or advice for your other artists or whoever that wants to go do stuff at San Quentin? Because I know they're always looking for people to come and volunteer.
Yeah. I feel like the most exciting thing about San Quentin is that they actually bring in a ton of outside people to the prison. Most other prisons in California are not like that. So if ever anybody has the opportunity, even just to like attend like a performance or something like that.
Yeah, you let me come to one of those. Yeah. You brought me over.
Yeah.
And that was really like a... Yeah. I'm so glad I had the opportunity to go to that, because it was like nothing I've ever been to before.
That's the best way to kind of be introduced to what it actually is like inside, because it's, I mean, the inside there still exists all the sort of crazy things that we think of when we think of prison, but there's also all the amazing community programs and stuff that exist at San Quentin. And I think if you ever have the chance to go in, I know there are quite a few public events, you just have to like sign up kind of early in advance and stuff. That allows people to see San Quentin differently from maybe how it's depicted in like media and on TV and things like that. And then to actually meet some of the guys and talk to them, I think is also super important.
Yeah, because, totally. Definitely, if you go, be sure to like mingle around.
Yeah. And some of the guys I know ask about you. Because they remember you.
I gotta go back.
Yeah, and they're like, when are your friends coming back, Amy?
Okay, good.
Yeah.
We gotta go. So, we gotta go.
Yeah.
And also to listeners that maybe don't live in the Bay Area, I know there's, you know, whatever, like, correctional facility, in quotes, is in your area, oftentimes has opportunities for people from outside to come in and do different stuff. I know my brother, like, led support groups at a prison back in Ohio. Wow. So another thing we've been talking about on the show recently, thanks to our sponsor, CompensationFoundation.org, is compensation for artists.
Oh.
Switching gears a little bit. Got any gripes?
Well, too many. How much time do we have? Yeah, I feel like there needs to be some sort of universal agreement that institutions that have a budget of a certain amount should pay artists a certain amount. Obviously, I'm not talking about artists run spaces where everybody's volunteering and working for free. But places where the people you're working with get paid. I think if they're getting paid, the artists should get paid too.
Right.
And when I say they get paid, it should be more than just like materials and travel. It should be like you're actually getting paid for your time, because everybody else is getting paid for their time, not to reimburse them for, you know, the cost of the vinyl or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I know it sounds, I think when some people think of art, they think, oh, it's like a, you should be doing it for free because you're having fun and
whatever. You know, but you're up there trying to debug the mainframe and like taking very intense measurements.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not all Jackson Pollock.
Yeah.
And even Jackson Pollock is really going for it. Yeah. So don't talk shit about Pollock. Yeah.
And it doesn't have anything to do, it doesn't have anything to do with like, oh, I want to make money from art. It has more to do with like, I'm a human being and need to live in the world and should be compensated for my time, you know?
Yeah.
Not like, oh, I want to make a fortune off of anything or anyone, but yeah.
And not to mention like, there's no art, there's no institution.
Exactly, like, yeah.
That's the bread and butter of the goddamn place.
Yeah, the institutions rely on the artists to create work so that they can bring in viewers, and their jobs depend on it.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Okay, get in there.
I mean, I also wonder sometimes if artists should also take some responsibility and kind of stand up for themselves as well.
Yeah, for sure. And although, that's hard.
Yeah, I'm terrible at that. So I guess I'm to blame also for this problem.
We all are. We all are. You know, when you point one finger out, you got three pointing back at yourself. JK.
I wish we could get Roscoe to bark right now, and then he'd be on the recording.
Roscoe!
He's not going to bark.
No.
He doesn't bark. Yeah.
Does he ever howl?
No. Oh. But he whines a lot.
I bet he could really yowl and howl.
But I've never heard him do it.
Oh, we always like to ask our interviewees if there's anything else they would like listeners to know. If you got anything maybe to promote or events or anything.
At RTS, we're going to have the Rhinoceros Project on December 16th. They're going to come and have a sewing circle and a potluck, and it should be a lot of fun, maybe kind of like a pre-holiday event.
Oh, so bring food.
Yeah, yeah.
Bring food, mm-hmm. But if you don't bring food, there'll be food.
Yeah.
But if everybody doesn't bring food, there won't be food.
Yeah. Yeah, but it should be fun, so it'll be right here at the studio.
Did you ever hear that old allegory about the couple that's going to this wedding? But it's like back in ancient times or something. And everyone's supposed to bring wine.
Oh.
But they all put it in a big vat or something. So all the wines get mixed together. Oh. And this couple's going to go. And they're like, we can't really be bothered to bring wine. What if we just kind of put water in a thing?
Oh, no.
And we'll just dump that in there. And nobody will notice because there'll be so much wine. And so they do. And then, you know, they go to toast or whatever, and everyone's going to drink the wine. And sure enough, it's all water because everybody didn't bring wine. Is that a real thing? Have you heard that one?
I've never heard of that story before.
But I feel like I heard it from a motivational speaker in high school, but they shouldn't have been promoting alcohol.
Oh, you had a motivational speaker come to your high school?
Oh my God, all the time. All the time. We had a guy come in and give a speech about abstinence.
Wow.
Where he took this big piece of tape and he put it on, had a volunteer come up and he put it on their arm. And they're like, okay, take that tape off your arm and put it on this other volunteer's arm. And they kept going. And he's like, look, the tape's not even sticky anymore. And that's what happens if you sleep around.
What?
I don't know. I think the thing was supposed to say, like, save yourself till marriage or you're not going to be able to, like, have a long-lasting relationship.
Oh.
I think he also played acoustic guitar.
Oh.
I'll be editing this all out of the show. Anyhow, Amy, thank you so much coming and talking to us today. And by us, I mean me.
Hey, thank you, Kate, for inviting me.
Of course. And as always, congratulations. Okay, everybody, Maysoon's going to be back next week. I know you miss her. You can send us some emails at congratulationspinetree@gmail.com, or you can call or text us at 419-351-6606. I hope you're having a lovely holiday weekend. And from the bridge to the other bridge, the island in between, this has been Congratulations, Pine Tree!